Stay hungry, stay foolish.
So now on the Innovation Show, it's a great pleasure to welcome Larry Bass, CEO and founder of Shinawil, who's given us great shows like The Apprentice, Dragon's Den, and the latest addition to the family, which is Dancing with the Stars, coming to our screen soon. So Larry Bass, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Aidan. Good morning.
So it'd be great before we talk about where the industry is today and where it's going, talk about how you got to where you are today and how you've got to these amazing shows that you've brought to our screens.
I had a very checkered road to where I am today. I started out in the business, believe it or not, age 13 as a DJ in pirate radio, all because somebody didn't turn up to do their show. My brother had been involved in pirate radio and out in Dunleary, and I was out helping by answering the phones and just hanging out, thinking it was really cool to be in a radio studio age 13, and somebody didn't turn up. I was elected to go on. I went on, and one thing led to another. I ended up, you know, working in various different radio stations all through my teenage years, all the way up to some of the biggest pirates in Dublin, including Radio Nova. And allied with that, I also started working, doing DJ in the local area, whether it was for a 21st birthday or a wedding or other functions, and then started supplying DJs and got involved in doing sound for fashion shows and stage shows, and that started introducing things like lighting and everything else. But I was always involved in, you know, the setup and the, I suppose, the behind the scenes production of various things, be it any type of event, from, as I said, fashion shows or school shows, right up to including rock and roll production. And that brought me down to a route of more and more of that when I left school. And it was all going well until I realized, you know, sort of towards my end of my 20s, that working at it the way I was wasn't going to be something that was going to be very fruitful in the future. So I decided to go back and try and educate myself properly. And I went as a mature student, applied for, at the time, it was College of Commerce in Rathmines through communications. And it's now DIT in Angel Street. Wasn't successful year one, but I managed to get into a foundation course in Colossia Dulig. Did that for a year, and then moved over to DIT, where I did a four-year degree in communications. Finished that and ended up working with a few different producers during my time in college, just to earn a few bob. And then I helped an old colleague from Radio Days in setting up a new production company. And post-production facility, decided that post-production wasn't the world that I want to live in. And I set up Shinawil Productions, essentially just to do a documentary for a band that we had sort of, I'd done sound with in previous years. But I knew their story had never been told. So a guy I'd met in college in Colossia Dulig, Simon Gibney, and myself set up Shinawil as a vehicle really to do a documentary on the Dublin band Aslan. And the documentary and the soundtrack from the documentary, Made in Dublin, actually was one of their best albums. It launched us as a production company. It got very well received. And eventually I started doing other things. And, you know, then we sort of got into the formatted television world when I stumbled upon the rights to do Pop Stars at a conference in Las Vegas. Eventually talked a few people into getting involved, you know, everyone from Simon Cowell, Louis Walsh and RTE, and the show was a big success, and that paved the way for us doing many other shows, including The Apprentice, Dragon's Den, MasterChef, The Voice of Ireland, Home of the Year, and now Dancing with the Stars. And we've done other shows as well. What Are You Eating was a new show we developed last year for RTE, and we've a couple of other shows working now with pretty much every broadcaster on the island.
Just going back to your childhood and I suppose your love of live production and production in general. Like you think of in life, there's black pen people, there's highlighter people and red pen people. I don't know if you've heard this analogy, but they say the red pen people are just people looking at an idea and just going, nah, that won't work. Highlighter people are who enhance it. And then you are very much a black pen person who just goes, what if we did this? And you just draw it up on the board. And, you know, when you said post-production, that kind of resonated with me that you weren't, I'm not the highlighter person. I'm not that. I actually want to be in the nuts and bolts of the vision and bring the vision to life.
Yeah, I think I'm the classic entrepreneur. I would drive some people to complete distraction. I don't go around life with a rearview mirror. I'm always trying to look forward. I'm always trying to look big. I read a book years ago and it had a big influence on my thinking. It was called The Art of Thinking Big. And for me, it just says it all. You know, coming from small town Ireland, where everything is small in comparison to the world of media, especially the changing world of global media, being small means you will remain tiny. And the only way you can actually strike out and take your part in the global village that is a changing media landscape is think huge, think absolute global, think big. And that served us well in a lot of our productions. We were never afraid of taking on big shows. We were never afraid of taking on big enterprises. And, you know, the challenge of, you know, how can you possibly do a show as good as it is in the US or the UK on a fraction of the budget? Well, we've always managed to do it. And I think that is key to getting going. I think if you allow the negativity of the people who will get stuck into the detail, stop something before you start, you're in trouble. I'm the exact opposite. Sometimes I start things that shouldn't be started because we haven't filled in some detail, like getting finance or other parts. But that, you know, we've been lucky as well. But so a degree of luck and a degree of thinking big.
Yeah, but that mindset of starting is where we all are today. Like businesses, big corporations, even if it's not in their culture to start things, they need to create little units or little pockets of innovation within the company that do that. And they go, you know what, there's no business plan for this. We're going to try it. It's going to cost this much. We were going to go this general direction anyway. And by failing, if we do fail, we've saved ourselves millions or hundreds of thousands by not investing big time in it anyway. And that mindset, you were very, very early with that, because that's what I was kind of getting at with your childhood, essentially, when you're 13. What was the, like, is there a spark there? So you mentioned the book Thinking Big when you were later, but was there something in your early childhood that you went, actually, that was a kind of a moment for me that I went, this is who I am, or this is where my mind is?
No, I think one of the key things, it's not really a sort of a personality thing, but it was certainly a big impactful event in my life. I had a fairly idyllic childhood thanks to hardworking parents, but my mum passed away when I was 12, and then my world completely, you know, just went upside down, and all the rules that I would have known pretty much up until that day went out the window, and a whole new set of, well, this is a different world and this is how you've got to go out and attempt to do things differently. So when things happened, because I didn't have mum at home and dad was out working, you just got on and did things. So I think I certainly gained an ability to think for myself much earlier than probably most people have to. And I think that has served me well. Whether it served me correctly or properly, well, history will tell. But so far, it's managed to serve me well, because I do believe you have to have an ability to make a decision. And you've got to get on with it. You've got to trust your instincts. You've got to trust your own innate ability in things, or nothing will happen. And I think in terms of some of those bigger productions and bigger issues, yeah, you make a decision somewhere along the way and you get on with it. And sometimes those decisions are not right, but you still get on with it and you've got to try and do remedial work on the way. But I think that certainly was key. We're on the innovation show, and it's only later in life I've started to realize the importance of, I suppose, everything from bootstrapping a new idea or setting something up or trying to do it differently and setting up and giving people the license to go off and try something, go off and do it differently. No one's going to shoot you for trying. And also bringing in play, I suppose one of the key rules in innovation is, you know, fail fast. Don't pour money down the drain. That's something when you're in a small business, you don't have the luxury of lots of money to pour down a drain. So you do have to try and fail fast or get going.
Yeah.
And I think that's been interesting. And now we've benefited as a company in actually making innovation part and parcel of our culture.
Yeah.
We're not there yet. We're trying to get everyone in the company thinking about innovation, thinking about how can we do everything we're doing different? Is there a smarter way? Don't just do it because you've been doing the same way. In a world where who knows what we'll be watching or what we'll be watching it on or how we'll find that content in the future. And that's changing so fast. You know, as content makers, we have to be open to being able to pivot our whole world into that changing environment. And I think that's key to trying to keep an eye on the future as you get through the day to day, which is always the difficult balancing act. But I think as a CEO of a business, as an owner of a business, I think I need to live a little bit more in the future than in the past. I certainly need to live a little bit more in the future than the present if I'm to grow the business. If we're happy with the business just stagnating and tipping along, you don't necessarily need to spend so much time on the future. You can just get on with what you're doing day to day. But certainly I think our business is future dependent.
Yeah, and it's so evident that, you know, that mindset comes, it's the shadow of a leader who infects the rest of the team for the better. And you've done that with the innovation mindset. And I suppose one term that's used a lot with a lot of innovators at the moment is hustle, to have some hustle. And that event in your childhood makes you have to hustle, because you have to hustle to, I suppose, fill the void in your life, but also feel the passion that you seem to have and the passion to create, and you've done nothing but that all the way. But the point being, as a CEO, within a company you can have pockets of excellence, but if the CEO isn't bought into that innovation mindset, it's not going to be an innovative company.
I think it's a real challenge, you know, trying to change the culture of a company, and even understanding the word culture. You know, until we did a program with Enterprise Ireland a number of years ago, I think it was 2013, called Leadership for Growth. And it was a really helpful program to allow me upskill my own, I suppose, managerial skills, business leader skills, and also set the company on a ship heading for growth, as opposed to just, you know, existing in the way we were within Ireland. And now we sort of, how do we grow faster? How do we grow better? Innovation is now another development into that sort of path. But it was on that program that I first sort of really got to know the meaning of the word culture within business. And it's a very, very powerful part of business. You know, culture eats everything else every day, all day. And we are not fully there yet. You know, our culture is something we're working on. We're trying to instill, you know, fun place to work, but a challenging place to work. We want to instill a culture where people come into the company, get on, move up in their career, get a chance to actually sit at the top table in terms of career paths. And also, I nearly expect people to want to be doing something in terms of learning and growth. And that sort of tells a lot about somebody. If they're not interested in doing training programs, they're not interested in learning new things, well, it sort of pigeonholes people into a certain place. And the ones who certainly grow and take leadership roles are the ones who make it their business to actually improve their skills. And so all of that combined with a philosophy of not standing still. I mean, I think it's key to, even in our business, on our domestic output, every show we do year in, year out, if we're lucky enough to get recommissioned, if we just plod along and do the same show, it won't last, you know, for the number of years that we hope shows will last. So we really need to fire up the team that if we're going to do a series again, it needs to be better. It needs to be bigger if possible. It needs to be, we need to be doing things different from what we did the year before. So from a viewer point of view, they're seeing a progression. They're seeing some change. Obviously, if there's fantastic parts of a program that the viewers love, well, you need to be very careful about tweaking that. You need to make the bits they love better.
And that leads me to that question. I was going to ask, how do you balance the innovation or the change or the incremental change or mixing it up with don't fix it if it ain't broken? And you're kind of going, how do I balance that? And how do you measure that balance?
It's difficult to measure it until you've done it. So sometimes you just have to have the courage to do something and hope that, you know, through a various means, you know, feedback is important. Feedback from your teams, test things with your customers. You know, our customers tend to be broadcasters. Have the conversation. Make sure you have got the ability to ask them what do they want to see different. You know, an awful lot of people probably go around the business and just assume things. Well, that's not necessarily going to be good enough in the future. I think we have to not assume anything and constantly ask and constantly get feedback. And feedback can sometimes be difficult, A, to get. And I find it's even harder to for people to give. But I think giving them the license to give you feedback is a very interesting thing to do.
Yeah.
It licenses people to engage. It licenses them to feel that they have an input. It licenses them to maybe correct things that, frankly, they weren't sure about what to say. But it gets you into a conversation. And at the end of the day, you know, we're in the business of telling stories. And those stories can go to a different place if people don't keep them on track or don't, you know, read the signs of where somebody wants the story to go. And what you don't want to do in a very big production is you think you know the story that the broadcaster network wants, and then you go off and make that story, and then you come back and deliver it, and it's actually a different story. So it's really, really it's quite simple in a way, but I think you've got to be able to have the ability to connect and communicate and have those conversations early and often. And I think that's part of it.
And one of the things, I mean, I always noticed Shinawil very active on early adopters with social media. And it's a great way to, I suppose, in real time, see how has it been reacted to? How's the content been reacted to? But also you use the analogy of the ship on the ocean and, you know, getting out there and not remaining stagnant, having a destination that will change. But the ocean today, if it's the ecosystem is changing dramatically and there's icebergs coming up all over the place, new little ships appearing all the way in your way almost, and there's fragmentation all over the place. And that means that you have to behave differently. And you see a lot of the networks not changing how they behave. And that onus is almost put on the production companies when maybe it shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, we're entering a world in terms of industry in revolutions. I think we've come through the industrial revolution. We've come through into the digital age. But we really are entering a phase now where I think we're practically leaving the digital age, and we're entering a phase that I don't know if anyone's coined the phrase yet for that new name. But we're certainly entering a phase that is more connected to the individual than ever before. You know, I think industrialization took the individual out of a lot of key processes, a lot of key thinking. And it was that industrial age drove a lot of policy and a lot of the key thinking and management. Yet now we're in a world where the democratization of especially social media and I would say not social media, but digital commerce, connecting the individual to their whole online world, their online stores, their habits, their desires, everything that sort of now is catered to an individual via these interconnected honeycombs of digital companies. You know, it's now a new world where the power is back in the consumer. And it's real power. I mean, you know, the most switched on companies are the companies who listen to their customers. And especially when customers can react instantaneously right now about a product, a place, a service. And the ones who don't react are, I suppose, the industries that will float away in that sort of big wild ocean where they're no longer...
sink.
Well, they're no longer relevant because people don't engage with them. Because
ghost ships, let's use that one.
And it could be that way. And obviously, bigger organizations take time to react and change. So I think big broadcasters, public service broadcasters, big commercial broadcasters, they will have internal processes that don't allow them to be as nimble as a lot of smaller production companies, for example. So we're like those little speedboats or jet skis even, who are nipping around trying things. And we've always had to be nimble. We've always had to be innovative and creative. I remember when we did The Apprentice in Ireland, we had to come up with a whole new funding mechanism just to make the show. It hadn't been done in Ireland before. And we didn't have the answers. We didn't even know we had to do it. We were left with this, how do we make this show with this particular broadcaster who at the time their budgets for programming just were not at the same level that they were in the national broadcaster. So we had to look at, well, what are our options? Where could the resource come from? Where could the commercial value in this be? And I think the same thing is starting to happen now in the social media world and digital media world. I think there is now some value propositions which, A, they're not recognised, B, they're not being utilised, C, they're, you know, people are not actually, I suppose, fully recognising the connection between that individual connection, the data that an individual wants to release, whether the individual knows what the data release is another thing. But there is a huge, huge value in all of this. And, in all walks of life, whether it's in biotech or in, the arms race or in, the food industry, the technology and the ability to hoover data and then pivot your service to all of that data is starting to influence what gets made. And I think the same thing needs to happen in our world of content. One thing's for sure, I think more and more people are consuming more and more content on more platforms. The one of the things I think will actually save the content is, I think there's some people will want higher level, and some people will want just strong storytelling. But as they're watching it, they want to be able to watch it at the best possible experience. There are, a huge amount of people will put up with lower level quality. But when you really want to sit down and you're sitting on the couch and you're trying to gather a couple of friends or family, you probably want to watch on the big screen. You probably want to watch it on 4K or whatever, the highest quality you can, together to have that sort of reaction. People do it with sport. You probably find watching a football match or rugby match on your own not as fun, as much fun, should I say, as watching with a group of friends or a pub full of friends or, obviously at the game itself. So I think that's true for an awful lot of activities in terms of our world of what is frankly just different forms of entertainment. Mm. And I think entertainment is something that is consumed and used better together. Gamers might disagree, but even gamers are now connecting. So they started out as people who sat in their bedroom probably playing a game and getting proficient at it and sharing their high scores with their friends. Now they want to play with their friends. They don't want to maybe engage with them, but they certainly want to do things together. The element of competition, the element of being able to discuss or see as live what's going on. If you're looking at humans as an anthropological study, there are certain characteristics which, even with the speed of change in digital world, the human beings don't change as quick. So our ability to still want to follow good story, simple narrative, is always going to be innate there. And I think that's what we're trying to do in our world. We're branching out into the world of TV drama and feature film and trying to connect ourselves to the market that is international. I think the big icebergs that are coming, frankly, haven't even entered the race. When you think about the people who are now commissioning and buying and paying for content internationally, it started out back in the 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s as the big studios for cinema and the big TV networks for TV. That world has certainly moved a hell of a lot since then. And the world we're now seeing, you know, where you've got the big disruptors to TV, being the likes of Netflix, Hulu and Amazon in this part of the world, they're interesting. Will they still be there in 10 or 15 years? Who knows? But the interesting companies who haven't yet, not yet entered the content race, you know, Apple, whilst they have a very successful iStore and Apple Store, and they're connected to so many parts of the world, they're not commissioning content today. Google have YouTube. They have, you know, there's various, they did try their Google video streams, but they seem to be putting all their video content wise down the Google route. But they're not commissioning full length content. I think the YouTube world of content is a slightly different world. And it's interesting that YouTube very much played, their first generation of their output was very much, you know, people just posting madcap stuff that they filmed on their phone or setups, and it was all, you know, short interstitials, and you know, it was never designed to be consumed as episodic returnable content. But now more and more of the quality, high-end, high subscriber based channels that YouTube are sort of pushing, you can see the difference. So whilst it's still a lot of bite-sized chunks of content, they are moving more to long form, because that's where you're going to get the eyeballs. That's where you're going to get the big eyeballs. Facebook have realized video drives content much more than all of the rest of their services. And the growth of video on Facebook is probably the fastest part of their growth, especially in a service that is saturated to the degree that they're, how many people have a Facebook account? So where you're going to grow? And certainly I think they're going to have to look at doing some content directly to that network, and bigger, longer form content. Why can't we be the first company to engage and do a Facebook drama or feature film or major event via Facebook Live? We found remarkable traction when we did some Facebook Live broadcasting on the set of The Voice prior to transmission of The Voice, where our coaches would do some sessions backstage. And it was remarkable to watch the viewership literally grow as you're going live. Technologies like Twitter on Periscope on Twitter. Where's that going to go next? Where is Twitter going to go? How are they going to be relevant in a world where content is going to be more important than just the message? And it's a very interesting world. You could sit back and go, oh my God, where's it going, and be very afraid. Or you could sit back and, you know, rub your hands with glee and go, isn't this just like fantastic? We're about to enter Disneyland and we don't know what's behind those gates and what our role is going to be in it. But I think we certainly want to see ourselves as a company who will innovate given the opportunity. A company who will try and change the rules, try and do things differently. But the one thing we will never compromise on, and I think that has to be key, we'll never compromise on quality. We're always going to be seen as, well, they're probably too expensive, we can't afford them. But I think if there's a Shinawil end board on a program, it has to be a sign of quality. It has to be a sign of, like, there's a certain level here that we're not going to dip below. And I think that's going to be the struggle, that struggle between quality and the desire for these new entrants to maybe push the boat out in terms of cost. Just because you can shoot and edit a movie in on an iPhone doesn't mean you actually want to, because, you know, I think what you lose in the aesthetics of filmmaking or TV drama making, if you try and go down the route of cutting all costs out, you will lose somewhere in the overall project that is high quality storytelling. And I think that's an exciting world.
Yeah, and it's there's so many nuggets in that chunk you gave us there. But the quality thing, like you see it with newspapers now, because newspapers obviously were under such threat that they compromised somewhat in quality and became clickbait and became about how many clicks or impressions instead of how many quality users you have or how many repeat visitors or how many signed in visitors you have. But just to go right back to what you said that was so valuable was the data part and building content out of data and what's working or not. Because I love what Reed Hastings did, the CEO of Netflix, where he realized back in 2009 or whatever it was that I'm under severe threat here because I do own the pipeline, but I'm under threat because I am so reliant on the content license. And if the content's not there, I won't have an audience and my network effect is screwed. So he goes, okay, I'm going to take a bet. And as you said, I'm going to push the boat out and I'm going to invest in content. And that totally redesigned the model, re-changed it, and actually probably saved the company initially. But you mentioned Facebook, and I was delighted you did, because the distribution, whoever owns the pipe has the power. Whoever owns that relationship with the audience has the power, coupled with quality content makers, people who create content that's high quality, that's authentic, and that, as you said, the Shinawil end board has a stamp of approval that you will go, this is Shinawil, this is what it means. Because then the Netflixes and the Amazons and the Hulus know, that's what I'm going to get. It's like the milkman who delivers every time. And that is such a powerful mix because it's the exact same as websites. People who have an aggregator site or a vanilla website who's not underpinned by data, who's not underpinned by top quality personalized content, are going to be like those ghost ships out to sea when no advertisers interested them. So it's really interesting. And then you talk about as well, embracing the frenemy and embracing the Facebooks and the Googles who may be a threat to so many people. But also if you use them correctly, you can absolutely revitalize your content and you use it as a recruitment tool using Facebook Live and those kind of things. Even knowing that Facebook are learning all the time from that, you know, Twitter buying the NFL rights are learning from all that. And then they're kind of going, one day they may just turn on the switch. But from a Shinawil perspective, you're still very relevant in that world if your quality is still high.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we need to try and crack, and we're not there yet, Ireland is a great country in terms of access to all of these key players in that world. So many of them have operations here in Ireland. The content side of their operations, I don't believe, are here. So if we want to talk to Facebook about content, the likelihood is that decision still being made somewhere in the States in terms of that R&D side of their business. I could be wrong. If there's somebody out there who, from Facebook who want to talk to us about content, I'm there. You know, similarly with Netflix, I had the pleasure of meeting Reed Hastings once, one of our dragons a couple of years ago, Sean O'Sullivan, was a first round funder of Netflix. So when they launched here in Ireland, he was able to introduce me to Reed. Unfortunately, I didn't get the chance to engage on the level I'd love to now that we know where our plans are going. And it is interesting that they've moved into Netflix Originals, as have HBO before them. I think they were following that sort of model of HBO. Amazon are a really interesting case. I think Amazon are obviously, they're a very, very big organization, usually dealing with selling people, started out from books into other goods and services. But they certainly want to engage with their clients, with their individual customers, and give them everything they want in their world. And content is now such a key part of that. Amazon Prime is one of the key drivers to grow their business. And not last year, but the year before, I think it was Amazon Prime, a network that is only available in four major territories, you know, North America, you know, USA and Canada, UK, Germany and Japan. Now, it obviously will roll out further. Commissioned 71 pilots. And those pilots are probably all cost somewhere north of $5 million. That's a lot of investment. And they went to series with over 40 of those shows. And interestingly, they went to series with the shows that the data back from their subscribers was above a certain level of positivity. So they didn't have people in ivory towers with qualifications called commissioners making decisions on behalf of their customers. They let the customers decide. It's dangerous to some. It's revolutionary to others. But for me, I think it's certainly something that we want to do more of. We set up a development arm called Makers TV, where we invited people in with ideas to develop their ideas in a hothouse scenario. He had done it with tech companies, so he was adamant that we should be able to do it with TV ideas. And it's a process where we're still going through a couple of those ideas with people. We learned a lot along the way. We also then, using Facebook, we set up a development call out in partnership with a distributor in Israel called TV by the People. And we did a call out just for TV ideas. And the qualification to discuss those ideas and be involved in the development group on those ideas was entry. So you had to submit an idea to qualify to be in the closed Facebook page. That then, once we started whittling down the ideas, it was that group who themselves got involved in talking about the ideas, given feedback, lots of it, on how the ideas might work better and pivot and change. And eventually the idea that won, which we're currently still evolving, still pitching to various people, but it was an idea which came, you know, from one individual who heard about the idea, pitched in an idea, and it went through the different stages. Now, I think a lot more of that's going to come on. So much so that people will just get more involved with the whole creativity role that is the world of film and television. Who's to say the next great TV series or movie franchise is not sitting in somebody's bedroom in their head? And they're not part of our world. They haven't been a writer, but they could have the most innovative story, because again, that's what will be on the page initially, that people want to see or hear. You know, J.K. Rowling created a franchise which the world has celebrated and enjoyed and consumed in millions, and in terms of value, in billions. Somewhere, someday, she had an idea. And that's all it was. And somewhere, someday, she had the ability to actually get it to the next stage. I think those stages are now disappearing. And now people can literally just pitch it. We're open for them. We're looking for them. And we know that it could come from anywhere. And I think, again, if you're not open to it, it won't happen. And that's the difference, I think, between people who have an eye in the future and the people who are living in the past. We don't know who our collaborators are going to be in the future. The only thing we can try and do is bring our experience to bear on the ideas and look to work with the very, very best, industry professionals in trying to make these things. But all in all, there are no rules to that entry point. And I think if you start putting up those rules, they're the people who will be left behind.
Yeah, and so for people who wanted to get in touch, Larry, how can they get in touch?
Well, we will have a new website. We're working on a new website, and on that people can connect directly to the company from the website. It's amazing amount of people who find me on Twitter and Facebook and everything else. So yeah. Look, I live, half of my life is quite public from that point of view because of the nature of the business. I'm not the type that leads every single little action of my day on social media, but it's for somebody who sort of grew up in an age without social media. It's funny how I've managed to let it infiltrate my life so much, but it's there. So yeah. You can't fight it. If it's there and you can't fight it, use it. So that's how people find me.
Okay. Well, Larry Boss, CEO and founder of Shinawil Productions, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Aidan.